Museum, but they still had stocks of unused wagons, and they had stocks of the latest model, the Mark 10, available. And they probably were still producing the Mark 10. And these were specially modified to operate in the desert area. You had the carburetor, air filtering arrangements, and things like that had to be modified to keep out as much of that fine silt and dust and sand as possible. And there were, of course, modifications required in the cooling system and things like that. So the aircraft were prepared, and they were in due course taken over by the crews. And there were lots of preparations of that nature that were underway, but the fact that these air crew were getting new aircraft would be secret right till the last moment. And when they did get them, they wouldn't be conscious of the fact that there was any difference, that they were desert-equipped aircraft. They were just getting more modern Wellingtons than they had before. Let's get back to the matter of personnel. I was very fortunate in the intelligence officers and operations officers that I took out there. Paul Hano was the senior intelligence officer, Squadron Hano. Quite useful to me in that he was completely bilingual. I think Hano had lived a great deal of his life in before the war. He was older than we were, than the average run of. He'd spent quite a bit of time in London. He had spoke with us, English with a very cultivated accent. No trace whatsoever of French-Canadian background, but yet he was quite fluent. He was equally fluent in French, and since we were in a territory, which we were heading for Algiers and Tunisia, but through Algiers, he was a useful person to have along. And on my staff, of course, we had a French-Canadian squadron, and they were, again, also useful in making contacts out there with the local authorities. Medical officers, I did extremely well. I had a most conscientious, overly conscientious, almost senior medical officer in squadron leader Ian McLaughlin. If the book said that water from the water hole required so many cc's of chlorine to make it potable, he would take the what the book said and double it or treble it. To the extent that you really almost needed the gas mask in order to drink your tea. But he was good, and he did a good job. And of course, we had our medical staff out there. Each squadron had a medical officer, I think, and I think I only had the one. So we had a total of four medicals. Not really. We didn't really undertake to have a hospital on the base or on the bases at all. If there was any hospitalization, it would have to be off base, except for we had a medical inspection room, naturally, and the odd bed in it. But squadron leader Ed Min, senior executive officer. I had chosen squadron leader Jeannin to go out with me. French-Canadian from Montreal, from one of the well-known families. I think his family firm was Jeannin and Company, big contractors in the city of Montreal. Very fine chap. Unfortunately, he met with an accident just before we were going to go out there, and had to be removed from the roster. And at that time, there was a squadron leader, McCann, senior administrative officer at Middleton St. George, which was one of our overseas bases. Danny was a very fine fellow. He was having a little bit of trouble, I think, with alcoholic trouble, and he had an incident which involved a crashed motor car and some injured people. he was in really in trouble. And I knew him, and I knew that the possibility of being sent back to Canada was very strong. And decided that I took him out to North Africa, and where there wasn't anything to drink, it might be saving of him. So I chose him as my Edmonopsis pick for dinner, and he proved to be absolute gem out there. I had a couple of fellows who were alcoholic, who had, you know, were on the verge of getting into trouble. I took another armament officer with me, who I was very fond of. I'd had him as my armament officer in Canada before I went over there. I took him out there, and he got straightened out, too. He and the can were very close, and since there wasn't anything to drink, they became very well behaved, and very stalwart officers of the unit. The two of them were absolutely brilliant in their activities out there. McCann had one of these happy personalities where he could make people, he could cheer people up. And under the conditions we were operating, there was always a lot of down on the most people. The temperature at times was 128 in the shade. The average temperature was, I shouldn't say the average. The normal daily temperature was 110. That was sort of a mild day. And the food was lousy, and the flies were fantastically great. And dysentery was rampant. And, so that there were some fairly sad people around at times.
Mm-hmm. I can believe
and old Danny McIntosh, now Danny McCann could cheer them up. He always had a smile. He didn't feel any better than they did, I don't imagine, but he was able to produce.
The food was bad. It wasn't very good. We're on British rations?
Yeah, we're on British rations.
Ah.
Yeah. Let me see if there's anyone else I want to particularly mention. There's another very cheerful... Now, these fellows who were cheery stand out in my memory. One of my senior code and cipher officer was a young man... Well, not so young man, but a lad by the name of Herb Fair from Vancouver. And he was another one of these fellows who was perpetually cheerful. And we have a few of those lads around the mess. It really is a great thing to boost morale. And of course, I had chosen my padres very carefully. And I took with me Padre Ashford, who had been with me at Leeming. I think I mentioned earlier that he was regarded as the outstanding Protestant padre in the RCF overseas. Where he went, the best Roman Catholic padre was invariably posted to match him all. Mm-hmm. So I chose him, and he was another one of these fellows who could cheer anybody. I didn't take his opposite number from Leeming, the Roman Catholic padre. I would have been happy to do so, because he was a very fine person, Father Smeaton. But he wasn't in very good health, and you had to bear that in mind when you were selecting a group to go abroad. So I therefore asked the Roman Catholic senior chaplain to suggest somebody to go out there with me. I told him I was taking Ashford, and I knew that would have an effect. So he nominated a chaplain. I've forgotten his name at the moment. He was again a very highly regarded Roman Catholic padre. Actually, the padre at Dishforth, where 425 Alouette's going and the French King's going. And I thought that he would be eminently suited. But again, unfortunately, he had a medical problem, and which wasn't evident until just before the ship was sailing. So they had to push somebody in there at the last moment. And it's really difficult to find somebody in 48 hours' notice. Mm-hmm. So there was a chaplain just arrived from Canada. 10 minutes on. In fact, he'd never been outside Quebec, nor had he ever been outside a little tiny community in the province of Quebec.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So he had a little difficulty adjusting, but he was a fine man nonetheless. But he had a few things to learn about life.
I guess he did, yeah.
and he did.
He opened his eyes.
Yeah, but it was very tough on him because, you see, he liked any knowledge of war operations. Ashford had been the chaplain to Canadian squadrons, not only at Leaming, but down at Four Group before that. And, he knew the problems of the air crew. He knew what was expected of the padre. He knew what the padre could do to help out the base personnel and the squadron personnel. And he had the faculty of... He had one of those remarkable memories where he could remember everyone by face and name from the moment he first met them. He'd get to know 2,000 people in a week and know them by name. So you can't duplicate that sort of thing very often. He was really good.
Must have been a tremendous education for the RC Padre to be associated with this fellow.
Yeah, it was. I'll mention that more about that later on. Well, enough about the formative period. The plan was that... I guess I better make one or two other points before I get to this stage. The squadron naturally were taking their own equipment out with them. So all that we were concerned with there was packing and moving. The wing had no equipment whatsoever because it was just being created and formed. It was dependent on their ministry to send the prescribed equipment package for a wing proceeding to a hot climb. We didn't know what we were going to get, but we had to rely on air ministries for that. They were also to provide all the tentage for both the wing and the squadrons, because the squadrons didn't have any tentage. They were to provide the cooking equipment and things of that nature that were required for field operations in that type of environment. So we had sort of a mixed bag. We had the Air Ministry providing certain stores for all the stores for the wing and certain things for the squadron, and the squadron packing up, taking its own stuff. I didn't see a schedule of equipment, and I suppose it wouldn't have mattered very much if I did. I didn't really know what they were providing. I had enough faith and that they had enough experience to send out the right things. And I guess by and large they did, although there were certain things we would have been glad to have that didn't come, and there were certain things that came that weren't worth a damn. And there was an inadequacy of tentage. You were never too sure you were going to get everything that was sent anyway, because the thievery on the docks in North Africa was fantastic. It wasn't all the Arabs. We had some special thieves in various units. For example, a unit short of tents would send a scout out an incoming ship and see if they could pinch down a few tents off the docks. With all the activities on the docks, I wasn't too difficult to do that. Just engage an Arab to go in there, because the Arabs are doing the loading and unloading, and in some cases, and they send a fellow in there and get something for them. So you're liable not to get it. Everybody was short of tentage out there, it seems. You were lucky, of course, if you got all your gear out there without losing some to enemy operations en route. There was lots of submarine activity in the Bay of Biscay, and we had to go down there, adjacent to the Bay of Biscay, to get through the men. Of course, lots of submarine activity in the men. So I think we were very fortunate. We didn't lose any of the gear to submarine action. All right, before we get that far, I should say that the ground crew were dispatched to Liverpool to go aboard ships. Two ships were involved in it. Two of the squadrons went, ground crew went aboard one of the ships, and the ground personnel and the of the wing and the ground personnel of one of the other squadrons went aboard the Samaria. I've forgotten what the other ship was, but there were two ships of both that class. And they proceeded up to Convoy Point. Actually, they went north to Convoy Point up off the Clyde before they headed outward. The air crew, the wing headquarters and personnel had formed at West Kirby. So they got together as a unit before they pushed off to the ship, West Kirby being very close to Liverpool. And then sometime later, the air crew assembled at Port Reese and down in South England, and they departure took place from there. Before they did that, they'd all gone to have their inoculations. And one of the injections that was required was anti-yellow fever injection. Although we didn't know it at the time, the plasma in which this was carried had been taken from somebody who had hepatitis. And,
oh boy.
We were to learn about that later on. Well, maybe I better tell you right here. What happened was that hepatitis broke out in... I had two bases out there. Dispersal requirements. We were still under some, not very frequent attack, but there was still a possibility of attack by enemy aircraft, so we had to disperse our machines. And therefore, it was regarded as too hazardous if I put all the three squadrons on one base. I would like to have had them on one base, but... I was forced to have two separate bases, and 424 Squadron was by itself over in a separate base. And the hepatitis, everything seemed to happen to 424, broke out there. And it was a strange thing that we got this ailment, which wasn't unusual in that part of the world. Everybody seemed to run into the army units in Sicily, you know, in Italy.
Oh, that's a lot of trouble.
I wasn't surprised it broke out, but... The thing that was perplexing was the fact that it broke out amongst the air crew. It didn't break out amongst the ground crew, it was the air crew. And that was a little difficult to fathom. It broke out on this one base amongst the air crew of this one squadron. And then a few days later, it started to break out amongst the air crew on the other base. Infectious hepatitis. And then it began to spread. And it spread. well, again, it was still going through the air crew. And then it began to spread to the ground crew. And but the ground crew reaction came quite a bit later than the air crew. So there was a distinct separation between the two. And that was one thing after we investigated and delved into this for a long period of time. It was traced back to those shots. And those people in the 424 Squadron went 2 days earlier to have their shots than the people from 420 and 425. And the 424 people got it at a certain number of days after those shots. And then the people of the other two squadrons got it a certain number of days after they'd had their shots.
The incubation period was working properly anyway.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And then, of course, the tools and utensils were not very carefully fiend, and I suppose the spreading mm-hmm. a bit from eating utensils.
Not too much in the way of washing, water for
no,
washing, I guess.
No,
there
wasn't.
Really.
No. Well, at any rate, there's a little digression. Let's get back.
Well, I would like to just pause. How seriously did it interfere with operations? How proportionally went down with it?
Well, we couldn't let it interfere with operations. This was very hard on the crews. First of all, we didn't have any hospitalization locally to put them in. You really should hospitalize for that. It's a fairly serious business. We couldn't, and the landings in Sicily were upon us, and we had to be able to push out a maximum effort. If we sent them away to hospitals, field hospitals, they'd probably never get them back again. So we'd these fellows feeling like death. You know, it's a very debilitating disease, and it gives you terrible diarrhea. We sent them out there with diapers on, great big towels wrapped around.
Dear me, yeah.
And and they weren't anxious to go to any Lyme field hospital. They'd rather, those fellows all would rather keep going and then and keep operating than they go off to some damned hospital somewhere else. So although the medical officer, my medical, would wring his hands, this fellow Ian McLaughlin, we carried on, and I don't know how many had injurious after effects. I think I mentioned to you one case that I felt perhaps was injurious in its after effects, and that was the case of Scotty McCann, a very happy executive officer of mine. He was one of the last to get it. It had progressed. You know, he wasn't air courier, so he'd gone.
Uh-huh.
He got it later on. And he had it all the time we were packing up to wind up our activities in North Africa. And the exec has an awful lot of work at a time like that. He just carried on slogging away. And he went downhill after that. And he was dead in 2 or 3 years after his lap. Often felt. And I never could figure out what it was that carried him off, but I often felt it was related in some way to that. Because his eyes never looked the same. You know how your eyes get all jaundiced with hepatitis and sort of shrivel up a little bit. His eyes never came back to normal after that.
Huh.
And he soldiered on. He stayed on in the Air Force when the war ended. And I can't tell you exactly what the date of his death was, but it was before the end of the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
It would be perhaps 48 or 49 or something like that.
He may have
and
suffered massive liver damage.
Yes, it could be. And in the end, he had fantastically high temperatures, and the doctors couldn't figure out what it was. It could have been that he picked up some very obscure tropical disease out there, which, on top of this other thing, added up to producing the end result, but they never did know. And I fought that case for 12 years against Veterans Affairs, and finally got his wife a pension. It did took 12 years.
Good heavens, 12 years, eh?
Yeah. Well, at any rate, we got the air crew and the ground crew aboard the two ships, and they were sent off properly. Air Marshal Edwards and some of his staff came over, and the band came and got them on their way. And of course, I was over there to wave them off. And then, some 2 weeks later, the aircraft didn't have to go at that time. Of course, it was better to get the ground crew out there and get the equipment off and unloaded from the ships before the aircraft went out. So it was. It would be late May or mid-May, I suppose, that the ground crew sailed for North Africa, and the air crew didn't depart until early June, first And yours truly and a couple of his senior staff flew out independently on a passenger transport. A week or so after the ground crew departed and a week or so before the air crew, got that. We flew from, I guess it was Port Reith, and went in one of those old C-54s with the bucket seats and so on. Long, hard night.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Took off from the cold and chilling nighttime of the UK, and it happened to be a cold period, although it was early summer, and landed at Marrakesh in Morocco. Hot as it could be. Again, Marrakesh is not one of the hottest parts of North Africa, but it seemed terribly hot to us on that occasion. We were still in blue, heavy blue uniforms. And we hadn't changed over to our summer things. That took place very quickly, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And then we actually refueled, and I think we had laid overnight in Marrakesh. Strange how hard it is to remember those things. And the next day we went on through Oran to refuel at Oran and headed for Algiers. And Algiers was to be my destination for a brief period because the headquarters of the Mediterranean Air Force was located in Algiers, and I had therefore a number of dealings to work out with them before we proceeded on down into Tunisia. That was my first contact with their Chief Marshal Tedder. He was the boss man of the Mediterranean Air Force, and a very fine, charming man he was. He had us out. When I say us, Squad Leader McCann and Squad Leader Boggs were traveling with me, and we went out to his place. He had a villa up in the hills, a bit outside of Algiers, and I guess it was really in Algiers, in one of the suburbs. And we met a number of his staff, and it was all very pleasant. Before I went out there, of course, Air Marshal Edwards, in his inimical fashion, said, "Now you're going to meet Tedder. He'll charm you. He is a very charming personality, or can be. But he said, I want you to be prepared to kick him in the balls if necessary."
One of his favorite things, I gather. Yeah.
That's pretty.
Bit of a task for a group captain, too.
He said, watch out, behind all that charm, you have to be on guard. Well, I don't really think that was the advice was necessary, but Edwards was not about to have any Englishman get ahead of any Canadian. I soon found that I had a few problems ahead of me, because when I went the following day to meet with members of his senior staff at the headquarters, and I discovered there was a great deal of waffling taking place as to where my wing was to operate, from what base it was to operate, or bases. And I discovered that they were talking and thinking in terms of having us operate from bases in the mountains, just to the westward of the plains of Tunisia. There had been bases there. The Americans had set up bases there when they were clearing the Germans and the Italians out of Tunisia. And the easy way out was to make use of these bases. Of course, I wasn't for operating a night bomber wing out of the mountains. The Americans operated from there because they had day bomber outfits. And that was quite a different matter. The facilities, aids to navigation and approach aids to airfields, in that part of the world was very primitive. It was primitive enough in the UK at that stage, but out there, I wasn't going to have any of this. So there were all sorts of arguments put up as to why it would be impossible to supply me, permit me to operate from a plane in Tunisia. The most compelling argument offered was that there weren't any more airfields. Every airfield that had been there and vacated by the Germans and the Italians was now occupied. There wasn't anything else. There wasn't time to make anything else. And secondly, the supply system to supply all those fields down there was so overloaded that to put three more squadrons down in that area would be beyond the ability of the supply organization to cope with. Both of those things are hard to deal with. I had no way of being sure whether they were right in what they said. I had a feeling that they were just taking the easy way out and offering me the use of fields already built. So, after a day or so in Algiers, I decided I'd better go forward and have a look. So I got aboard a Dakota and flew up to Constantine, to Tulerga. Tulerga was the airfield for Constantine. Constantine was a very ancient city with a name dating from Emperor Constantine, close to the border of Algeria and Tunisia. And in that city was the headquarters of General Doolittle, who was to be my boss. Doolittle was the commander of the North Africa Strategic Air Force, NASA. So I flew there and went to see General Doolittle, and his number two was General Partridge, Brigadier General Partridge, who later was to be the first, this is rather interesting, Commander-in-Chief of NORAD, when NORAD was first formed.
Oh.
When Roy Simon went down there to be the Deputy Commander-in-Chief of NORAD, his boss was four-star general by the name of Pat Partridge, and one of the finest people you could find the world around. So I was very fortunate in having Pat Partridge in the headquarters in Constantine. It was in an art museum, the headquarters. The center of his office was a beautiful statue of Venus, with a hand held high on one hand and low on the other, and his little born aft cap was always hanging on the top of this upstretched hand of Venus. I found that this team of Doolittle and Partridge, the most cooperative pair of officers I'd run across in my life, they would do anything to help you. I told them my problem, and I said I'm very unhappy about it, and I don't think it's right. I'm going to do my utmost to circumvent this. So they were both very sympathetic, and they were both out to do anything they could to help. And Pat Partridge said, "I'll tell you what I would do. I would get aboard an aircraft and I'd fly right down to Tunisia and go and see Group Captain Powell, who was commanding 330 wing." That was the other wing sent up from the UK. They'd arrived a few weeks ahead of me. Talk to him and find out whether it is in fact true that the supply situation is as tight as it is, and whether it is in fact true that there are no more suitable bases available. So, and I said, well, how do I do that? How do I get an aircraft to... He said, I'll let you... He said, I've got a little 86 out there. 86 is something equivalent to Harvard. I think that terminology...
Oh, yeah.
The Americans use it. It wasn't quite a Harvard, but something that almost identical. He said, you go out there to the airfield and I'll phone out and tell him to roll out my 86 and you can, it's a two-seater job. So I took, Boggs was traveling with me, my engineer officer. I took Boggs. And away we went out to the airfield and sure enough, there was the little 86s out there and ready and I'm into the operations.
Operations tent, and I said, I would like to be briefed on the route from here to Carawan. Carawan was the the nearest city or town to, are we all right?
Oh, yeah.
Nearest city or town to 330 wing. And indeed, the other Wellington wings were all centered around Carawan. Holy holy city, Muslim city there. He said, well, there isn't anything briefing I can give you. I said, all right, can you give me a map? He went off and fumbled around like the map chest. He said, no, it's all right. All the maps of that territory have been issued. He said, we haven't really got anyone interested in that area these days anyway. I said, well, is there a road map? Oh, he said, I'm damned if I know whether there's a road map available. He said, there aren't any roads. Maybe there aren't any road maps. And he scurried around. He did find a road map. And, of course, there were roads along the coast, but I wanted to go straight across inland. Well, it wasn't much of a map, but I took off of this thing, and it was about a 300-mile flight. Yeah. I didn't expect to have too much fuel left at the end because Harvard wasn't designed for long-range operations. There were two mountain features indicated on this map, and they were pretty well on the route. They were breaking up, prominent enough to be named on the map, so I reckoned they'd be sort of a landmark. Sure enough, they turned up at the right place at the right time. So I just kept plugging on that course and had worked out my ground speed as best I could under the circumstances without any outside assistance, and kept going east and east and east, and eventually, on the horizon, I saw this rather attractive city looming up, white buildings standing up on the plain, and it was Carawan.
Oh, boy, right on, eh?
And I... I had been told roughly the position of 330 wing in relation to Carawan, so I struck a heading off in that direction. There were airfields every place. You had to be a little careful to make sure you got the right one. I could see airfields all around there and there's planes. So I struck a course off from Carawan, and the heading that I'd been told was the heading to B.D. Powell's base, 330 wing. And sure enough, I landed there, and this fellow Powell turned out to be very helpful. And we got down to business right away, and I told him what my problem was. He said, I quite agree. He said, you'd be absolutely crazy to operate from those bases in the mountains. He said, they staged me through there. And he said, I think perhaps they thought they were going to keep me there. He said, don't listen to all that cock about the logistics. He said, you find yourself two bases down here, and you go back to Algiers and tell them that you've located two bases. They'll soon find the gasoline and the bombs and the food and what's necessary. So I said, fine. That's just exactly what I'm looking for. But I said, how do I go about this? I said, are there any bases available? He said, no. He said, there's been such a buildup in preparation for the forthcoming operation, the landings in Sicily, that every available airfield, and he said there were an awful lot of them, is occupied. But, he said, if you could get on the right side of the major over beyond Karawan at the U.S. Corps of Engineers unit, I think he could build you a couple of fields in a few days' time. He said he and his outfit are quite renowned for the speed with which they can put things in shape. He said, I'll arrange for you to go over. He said they have a poker game every Tuesday night, and tonight is Tuesday. He said, I'll get him on the phone and tell him that that he and I would like to, that you and I would like to come join this poker game. So I went over there and got into this game. I didn't know much about poker, but I was prepared to lose the money in order to get what I wanted.
Right, yeah.
So we had quite an evening, and I had taken out with me, you know, alcohol was terribly hard to get in England at that stage, and it was impossible to get in North Africa. I had taken out two bottles of Canadian VO, two bottles of VO whiskey. And I knew that that was all I was likely to be able to lay hand on for at least a month or two because of the tightness of the supply system. But I decided maybe I better throw those into the pot, too. So I took those over to the poker party.
You had them with you, didn't you?
I had them with me.
Oh, clever of you, yeah.
I had them with me. Yeah. I took them over. In fact, I was traveling with all my gear. And, I've got this just a little bit out of phase. That's right. I went back to Telugma after that first visit with Powell. Because that poker game was not that first night, it was a couple nights later. I went back and I brought to I returned to the base and I just talked things over with Doolittle and Partridge again. And then I went down to especially to see the major and the Corps of Engineers. And it was then that I took the two bottles with me, that's right. And I think that they were most helpful in softening things up. We had quite a rugged evening. And I was introduced into intricacies of Mississippi mud and baseball and all sorts of weird and wonderful poker variations. And Mississippi mud, and there was another one with a rock crusher. I don't know if they ever run across Rock Crusher.
No.
Rock Crusher, Mississippi Mud, and baseball, and whatnot. Well, I lost some money, and I lost, of course, my whiskey to a good cause. And I discovered that, in talking to this fellow, that he was one of these chaps who hated to fly. He was very prone to be airsick. But I had to convince him to come with me the next day and reconnoiter some possible areas. And I promised that I'd pick him up early in the morning and that we would take off before the air got rough. So we got off shortly after dawn and went over. And of course, I had to go out in the fringe areas. All of the close-in places and all of the nice places and a few olive trees were all gone. We were really out in the blue, out in the desert. But there were, and we were getting out close to the mountains, too. This meant heading about 40 miles southwest of Karawan. And we went out there and I landed in a likely lucky place. Ground's pretty flat and level over there. And No, I guess I wasn't able to land. No, the ground was covered with thistles. At that time of the year, nothing grew out there but thistles. It wasn't really a desert. It had been one of the great granaries of the Roman Empire at one time. It had been irrigated by huge aqueducts. But it was the ravages of time, these had been knocked down. And had reverted. No longer was a desert. It was converted from a desert area to huge wheat fields or corn fields, whatever they, what have you, a couple thousand years earlier. And then it had gone back with the destruction of the aqueducts. It had never become entirely sandy again. It was sort of a silt. And it grew nothing but thistles. And the thistle flourished. I saw pictures of it. When I went there, the thistles were burnt brown by the heat. But I saw pictures taken earlier when there was just a crop of green thistles and flowers. And it was really quite a sight. They grew to a height of about 5 or 6 feet.
Oh, boy.
They really flourished. And as I say, as the summer progressed, and in that intense heat, they just shriveled, they burnt up. They still stood up, but they were sort of tinder crisp.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't really land on it. We flew over, and we, at very low altitude, and we saw that there was, all those areas were interspersed with wadis, but there were enough flat areas in between the wadis that we could lay out. It looked as though we could lay out an airfield, provided the texture of the ground was suitable. So having done this, and I scouted out two areas because I knew there was a possibility we might need two fields. Having done this, I took him back and landed at 331 Wing Airfield, and then we got aboard one of his jeeps, and we drove out there. We scouted out on foot, and he'd go around with the heel of his boot, and that's sort of a metal heel protector on his boot, and he'd kick his heel into the ground. That was his soil testing. And he concluded, having kicked his heel in the ground in a variety of places, that yes, he could build an airfield there. yes, the roots of the thistles would bind the soil sufficiently that it wouldn't blow away. And it was feasible provided nobody ever put a bulldozer on it. He said, I've got a battery of rubber tire rollers over here, in which we put water in a water tank and to give it some weight. And we tow those behind the jeeps. He said, all I want you to do is to put markers up there. He said, put two or three gasoline drums, one on top of the other, so we could see them from a distance. And put those markers on the on the four points of your runway. And lay out your dispersal areas and lay out your road system with markers. He said, I just come in with these rubber tire things and we just drive down the runway at about 20 or 30 miles an hour and knock over the thistles. They'll break off clean at the base and we'd leave the roots. And he said, you have an airfield. He said, you may have a fire hazard with all these thistles around, but he said, you'll have to live with that. I said, how long will that take? Oh, he said, it might take 48 hours, maybe less. He said, at any rate, I said, I think I could do one airfield less than that, but might take a little bit longer to do the second. So it was agreed that I would return to Telergma, to Constantine, and come down there and with a number of my staff, and we would lay out the key points, guide points for them to use. So I put in two double runways,